Chapter 3, Moisture and Texture, from the World Cooking Systems Atlas. After this chapter, the next time a sauce slides off your pasta, your fried thing tastes oily instead of crisp, your custard weeps, your bread soaks through, or your stew feels like two ingredients sharing a bowl instead of one dish, you'll know which moisture transaction was botched and which side of the wet-dry quadrant the recipe was trying to live on. Texture is the cook's most underused tool. There is a quiet asymmetry in how recipes are written. Almost every recipe tells you what to do: chop, add, simmer, stir, rest. Very few tell you what the dish should feel like at the moment of each step or at the moment of the bite. The mouth is the final arbiter of cooking. The recipe leaves it as a footnote. This is the underused tool. The cook who pays attention to texture has a second instrument that most recipe followers never reach for. The cook who pays attention to moisture has the lever that drives texture. Almost every textural failure in the home kitchen is, when you trace it back, a moisture transaction that went the wrong way. Water moving where it should have been held still, or held still where it should have been moved. This chapter is about that lever. It introduces a small grammar for moisture, four transactions, one rule for each, and shows how the great dishes of half a dozen cuisines use the same four moves to produce textures that feel completely different on the tongue. The chapter does two things at once. First, it gives you a vocabulary. Wet into fat, wet into dry, dry into wet, dry into dry, a quadrant you can read any recipe against. Second, it gives you a principle that once you see it, you will see everywhere. Nearly every dish you love has at least one crunchy element and one yielding element on the same fork. Texture contrast is not garnish, it is the architecture. If Chapter 1 taught you that seasoning is a sequence, and Chapter 2 taught you that fat does three independent jobs, this chapter teaches you that moisture is a transaction. Every cooking step is moving water from one place to another, or refusing to let it move. Once you can name the transaction, you can name the failure, and once you can name the failure, you can fix it. The three jobs of moisture. Moisture, like fat, does more than one job. Confusing the jobs is the most common source of texture failure in home cooking. Hydration, making structure possible. Most foods can only exist as the food we recognize because they have absorbed water to a specific level. Bread is flour that has been hydrated to roughly 65% of its dry weight. Below that ratio, you have a cracker, and above it, a batter. Rice goes from inedible kernels to fluffy grains because each grain absorbs about 2.5 times its weight in water. Custard sets because eggs absorb dairy until the proteins crowd against each other and lock. Pasta cooks because semolina draws water into the dry starch and the gluten swells. Hydration is the moisture transaction that gets ingredients to the point where they can become a dish. If hydration is wrong, every later step compounds the problem. Underhydrated dough cannot stretch. Overhydrated batter cannot crisp. Underrehydrated dried mushrooms taste like the inside of a bag. The hydration rule: most ingredients have a hydration target, and you should know what it is before you start the recipe. Bread cooks know hydration percentages because they have to. Most home cooks treat hydration as the byproduct of follow the recipe. They are usually fine until the recipe is wrong, or the flour is different, or the weather is dry, at which point they have no idea what to adjust. Distribution, moving moisture where it needs to be. Once an ingredient has the right amount of water, the cook's next job is to move the water through the dish in a controlled way. A risotto is a long sequence of distribution. The rice releases starch into the broth carries the released starch through the dish, and the cook's stirring keeps the distribution even. A stew is a slower version of the same idea. The protein and the vegetable each release water. The released water carries fat-soluble aromas into a common phase, and the result is a single integrated liquid, rather than chunks of meat sitting in seasoned water. Distribution failures are subtle. A stew can be perfectly cooked and still taste like it has not married. Each ingredient retains its individual moisture profile. None of it carries flavor between the others, and the bowl reads as a list rather than a dish. The fix is almost always longer, gentler cooking. Not more salt, not more fat, not more anything. Time is the distribution tool. The distribution rule: moisture in a dish should be one continuous phase, not several private ones. When the dish reads as a list, the moisture has not yet bridged. Retention, keeping moisture where it needs to stay. The third job is the one most recipes describe most poorly. Don't overcook the meat is moisture retention advice without the mechanism. The mechanism is this: protein fibers tighten as they heat, and tightening squeezes water out, and water that has left the meat cannot be put back. The window of doneness in any protein is the window between structurally cooked and starting to squeeze. Past that window, the meat is dry and no sauce in the world will fix it, because the sauce is sitting on the outside of muscle that has already lost its water. Retention failures are the most visible. The chicken breast that is gray and stringy, the egg that has fallen out of its custard back into its component parts. The braised lamb that has shed all its moisture into the pan and turned to fiber. In each case, the cook held the protein past its retention window. The retention rule: every protein has a temperature past which it loses moisture irreversibly. Stop at or before that temperature. For chicken, the window closes around 74 degrees Celsius internal epithigh, also the safety threshold, so the moisture rule and the safety rule line up. For salmon, the texture window, the temperature band where the cook decides what mouthfeel the dish will have, sits roughly between 50 degrees Celsius and 60 degrees Celsius, with meaningful textural change every few degrees inside that window. Safety guidance for salmon belongs to a separate conversation that depends on sourcing and audience, not to this chapter. For eggs, the white sets at 62 degrees Celsius and the yolk at 70 degrees Celsius. For most cuts of beef, the texture changes meaningfully at every 5-degree step above 55 degrees. These numbers are not arbitrary. They are where the moisture transaction tips. The wet-dry quadrant, the failure map. If you remember nothing else from this chapter, remember this diagram. Cooking is mostly about putting wet things next to dry things. The two will trade moisture. The question is always, which direction is the moisture going to flow? And is that the direction you wanted? There are four possibilities. Three of them work. One almost never does. Wet into fat, failure. A wet ingredient lowered into hot fat is a small explosion. The water at the surface flashes to steam in milliseconds. The steam can lift droplets of oil out of the pan. If the food was very wet, the steam and oil interface can spit far enough to be felt across the kitchen. Even when nothing burns, the wet surface of the food is now coated in displaced oil rather than getting hot. The crust never forms because the surface cannot exceed 100 degrees Celsius while there is still water to boil off. And the result is greasy, pale, and limp. This is the failure most home cooks intuit but cannot name. I dropped the fish in the pan and it went gray and oily. I tried to sear the broccoli straight out of the wash and nothing happened. Both are wet into fat. The fix is unromantic. Dry the surface before the food touches the fat. Paper towels are fine. Salt and rest works for vegetables that release their own water. Air drying overnight in the fridge gives the best crust on poultry skin. The principle is the same in every case. The surface that meets the fat should be drier than the surface that meets the air around the pan. Wet into dry, success. A wet ingredient meeting a dry surface is one of the cleanest cooking moves there is. Dough lowered onto a hot stone, batter dropped onto a screaming hot pan, wet stew meat seared in a dry bottom skillet. The dry surface conducts heat into the food with very little energy lost to evaporation. The water at the contact zone vaporizes immediately into the dry environment, and the food develops the brown, crisp, aromatic layer that the cook was after. The two great cooking moves of crisping and browning both live in this quadrant. So does the single most underrated technique in the home kitchen, starting cold proteins in a dry, cold pan and letting them heat up together. The pan is dry. The protein releases its water into the pan as both come up to temperature. The water flashes off, and the protein is now sitting in its own rendered fat with a crust already forming. Bacon teaches this lesson best, but it works for chicken thighs, sausages, and duck breasts. The rule is the same. Dry surface, wet ingredient, conduction does the work. Dry into wet, sponging. A dry ingredient lowered into a wet environment will absorb moisture until it reaches its hydration target. This is the basis of every braise, every stew, every risotto, every rice cook, every pasta cook, every soaking step. The variable the cook controls here is rate. Hot water moves into dry starch fast, cold water moves slowly. Acidic water, vinegar in a brine, tomato in a stew, moves at a different rate than plain water. Salty water moves faster than fresh in some cases and slower in others. The cook who knows the rates can make dried mushrooms taste alive in 20 minutes. Hot water, wait on top to keep them submerged. Or can make a piece of dried fish take 3 days to come back. Cold water, change daily. The dry into wet quadrant is also where most of the world's slow cooking lives. Beans, pulses, tougher grains, fibrous vegetables, collagen-rich cuts of meat. All of these are dry into wet transformations that take hours, sometimes longer. The reward is texture that no shortcut produces. Dry into dry. almost always failure. A dry ingredient meeting a dry surface with no water in between to mediate almost always fails. Bread tossed into a dry pan turns to a cracker. Plain pasta lowered into a dry pot burns. Dry rice tossed into a dry skillet scorches in seconds. The reason is that without moisture to absorb heat through evaporation, and without a continuous liquid phase to distribute heat evenly, the food's surface gets to scorching temperatures before its center starts to cook. The almost in almost always failure is doing some work. Toasting whole spices, dry roasting nuts, dry curing pasta in a hot pan to develop a roasted flavor before you cook it, the genius of Fideuà. These are deliberate, controlled excursions into the dry into dry quadrant, and they work because the cook is courting a specific Maillard reaction over a known time window. Outside those known cases, dry into dry is the failure pattern that home cooks stumble into when they're improvising. Different families of dishes solve the moisture problem differently. The vocabulary varies, the grammar is the same. The set family, moisture locked into a structure, custards, quenelles, mousses, panna cottas, soufflés, chawanmushi, flans. Each is a moisture that has been locked into protein, starch, or air structure, such it holds its shape on the plate. The technical move is consistent across all of them. Bring a liquid containing the structuring agent, egg, gelatin, starch, to a temperature at which the agent sets. Hold it there long enough for the set to complete, then stop heating before the set tightens too far and the liquid weeps. The failure here is overshoot. A custard that has been held 30 seconds too long releases water as the proteins squeeze. A chawanmushi that was steamed too aggressively curdles. A flan that was baked too hot pulls away from the ramekin in jagged sheets. Each of these is the retention rule failing. The structure has been held past the moment when it could keep its water in. The drain family, moisture removed before cooking, yogurt cheese, labneh, drained ricotta, salted eggplant, salted cucumber for tzatziki, branda de maru, bacalao mantecato. Each of these starts with an ingredient that contains too much water for what the cook wants to do with it. And the first move is to take some of the water out before the heat ever arrives. The drain family is where moisture as flavor concentration shows up most clearly. The drained yogurt is more yogurt flavored than the original. The salted eggplant tastes more like eggplant. The brandade is salt cod that has been rehydrated specifically so the cod's salt-concentrated flavor distributes evenly through the dish. Without rehydration, the cod is too dense to eat, but the entire reason for the dish is the cod's preserved flavor. The cook's clock is patience. Most drain operations take longer than you expect, and shortcuts produce a half-drained mess that is neither here nor there. The carry family. Moisture as the carrier between ingredients. Soups, sauces, braises, stews, risottos, jus, gravies. The moisture is the medium that carries flavor between the dish's separate components. The cook's job is to make the carrier rich enough through extraction, reduction, and emulsion that it bridges the ingredients into a single dish. This is the family where the distribution rule matters most. A soup that is technically done can still feel uncomposed. The cook fixes it not by adding ingredients, but by giving the carrier more time. A sauce that tastes flat usually has a carrier that is too dilute, and the fix is reduction, not seasoning. A stew that reads as a list is a stew where the carrier never bridged. The sponge family, dry ingredients drinking moisture, bread that soaks up sauce, pasta that drinks pasta water, bulgur that swells in dressing, couscous, rice, dried mushrooms, breadcrumbs and meatballs, croque monsieur, the entire identity of the dish is bread acting as a moisture scaffold for a sauce that would otherwise have nowhere to live. The cook's variable here is timing. A sponge that is added too early in a sauce becomes soup. A sponge that is added too late has not yet drunk and reads as separate from the dish. The classic Italian pasta risottata, finishing dried pasta in the sauce so it drinks the sauce as it cooks, is the sponge family being exploited deliberately. So is the use of bread or breadcrumbs as a thickener, the Spanish salmorejo, the Tuscan papa al pomodoro, where stale bread becomes the moisture scaffold and the body of the dish in the same move. The crisp family, moisture driven out fast, fried things, blistered things, the bottom of a pan-fried rice cake, the skin on a roast chicken, the surface of a seared scallop. The cook's job is to drive moisture out of a thin surface layer as fast as possible, while the interior stays at whatever moisture level the recipe calls for. The reward is contrast. a crisp layer over a yielding interior. The Crisp family is the family that most reliably teaches the texture contrast principle, which the next section is about. 5. The texture contrast principle. Take any 12 dishes you love, across cuisines, across centuries, across cooking styles. Make the list specific. A particular roast chicken, a specific pasta carbonara, a particular bowl of pho, a remembered croque monsieur, an Anatolian Monty, a Tex-Mex carnitas taco, a Brittany galette, a Cantonese roast goose. For each one, list every textural element on the plate and label each one as crisp, yielding, creamy, fibrous, crunchy, or fluid. The pattern emerges immediately. Nearly every great dish you can name has at least one crisp or crunchy element and at least one yielding or creamy element on the same fork. The croque monsieur, crisp toasted bread yielding melted cheese, creamy bechamel underneath. The carnitas taco, crisp lacy edges on the meat, yielding interior, crunchy raw onion, fluid lime juice and salsa. The carbonara, yielding pasta, crisp guanciale, fluid egg and cheese sauce, crunchy black pepper. The pho, crisp Thai basil and bean sprouts added at the table, yielding rice noodles, fluid broth, fibrous beef brisket. The roast goose, crisp skin, yielding meat, fluid fat that has rendered into the cavity, fibrous shred at the carving point. This is not coincidence. The mouth is interested in contrast. A dish with only one texture, no matter how perfectly executed, fatigues the palate within 3 or 4 bites. A dish with two opposite textures stays interesting through the entire plate. This is why so many home-cooked dishes that follow the recipe perfectly still feel boring. They are textural monocultures, all creamy, all soft, all fibrous, all crisp. The recipe has not asked the cook to build contrast, only to cook the central element. The fix is small. One crunchy garnish, one creamy spoonful, one acidic finishing element with a different mouthfeel. The dish becomes alive. There is also a darker reason texture contrast matters. It is one of the strongest signals the mouth uses to register freshness. A dish where all the textures are the same reads as old, even when it is not. A dish with sharp contrast reads as fresh, even when most of it was made yesterday. Restaurants exploit this constantly. Home cooks would benefit from doing the same. The texture contrast inventory in the diagram section at the end of this chapter walks through 12 dishes element by element. It is the most useful single exercise in this book. 6. Worked examples from the catalog. The site's own recipes provide every dish reference below. The point of this section is to show how the moisture grammar reads against real dishes. Aioli, moisture control in a raw emulsion. The aioli is a moisture transaction that the cook performs without heat. Egg yolk is roughly half water. The rest is fat, protein, and the natural emulsifiers, lecithin in particular, that hold the phases together. Olive oil is almost entirely fat. The cook's job is to coax the water phase of the yolk to disperse into millions of droplets of oil, so that what was two phases reads as one creamy phase on the spoon. The variable the cook controls is the rate at which oil is added. Too fast, and the water phase cannot keep up, and the emulsion breaks. Slow enough, and the water in the yolk is drawn into smaller and smaller droplets around each new addition of oil. The aioli teaches the moisture lesson in its purest form. The dish only exists because the cook held water and oil in one phase against their natural inclination to separate. For the raw yolk safety note, pasteurized yolk is the safer choice for pregnancy, immunocompromised diners, very young and very old eaters. See Chapter 2, Section 4. Brandade de morue, pulling moisture out of cooked fish. Brandade is salt cod that has been desalted in changes of water for 2 days, then poached briefly, then beaten with garlic and olive oil, and in some versions, potato, until the cod fibers release enough moisture to take on a creamy, spreadable texture. The dish lives in the drain family and the set family at once. The desalting is a long drain operation that resets the cod's water level, and a final beating is a controlled release of the cod's intramuscular moisture into the oil to create the spread. A brandade made from properly treated salt cod tastes like nothing else. A brandade made from fresh cod tastes like creamed fish. Fine, but unremarkable. The dish is a moisture transaction across 48 hours. Chawanmushi, moisture set into a custard. The Japanese steamed egg custard is the set family's lightest expression. The egg is whisked with dashi at roughly 1 part egg to 3 parts dashi. Strained for smoothness, gently steamed in covered cups until the protein set. The right chawanmushi reads as a savory silk that yields to the spoon and releases the dashi's umami into the mouth. The failure mode is overshoot. Steam too aggressively or hold too long, and the proteins squeeze the dashi out into a watery puddle at the bottom of the cup. The texture goes from silk to scrambled. The fix is gentler steam, controlled time, and removing the cups the moment a toothpick pulls clean. Okayu is rice porridge made by simmering rice in 5 to 10 times its weight of water until the grains have absorbed everything they can and started to break down into the surrounding liquid. The texture target is the whole point of the dish. The rice is no longer rice, and the water is no longer water. They have become a single creamy phase that reads as comfort food when you are well and as nourishment when you are not. The dish teaches the dry into wet rule. The slow rate variant, cold water start, very low heat, 2 hours, gives the silkiest texture. The fast rate variant, boiling water, vigorous simmer, 40 minutes, gives more distinct grains and a thinner liquor. Same ingredients, two different dishes. The cook decides by deciding the rate. Hummus, puree moisture as a structural element. Hummus is a puree whose creaminess depends on how much of the chickpea starch has been released into the surrounding tahini and oil. The cook's variable is how long the chickpeas were cooked. Longer, more starch release, creamier puree, and how warm the chickpeas are when they go into the food processor. Warmer equals the starch in the oil emulsify more readily. A hummus made from canned chickpeas pulsed cold tastes grainy and divided. A hummus made from chickpeas simmered an extra 40 minutes with baking soda, then pureed while still warm with tahini and ice water, achieves the silkiness that the home cook who has tasted it at a Lebanese cafe could rarely reproduce. The difference is entirely a moisture distribution choice. Cinnamon roll, dough moisture versus filling moisture versus glaze moisture. A great cinnamon roll has 3 moisture layers, and they are all different. The dough is hydrated to a soft, enriched bread texture, high moisture, but bound by gluten, so it reads as fluffy rather than wet. The filling is butter and sugar and cinnamon, which during baking liquefies and partially soaks the inner spirals, moisture moving outward from the filling, briefly, then setting again as the sugar reconcentrates as the roll cools. The glaze is a soft icing that sits on top and slowly seeps into the upper surface as the roll cools, adding a third moisture layer that is sweet and almost dripping. A cinnamon roll that fails almost always fails because one of these 3 moisture levels was wrong. Too much glaze, and the roll feels soggy on top. Too little filling, and the spirals read as dry bread. Underproof dough, and the entire roll feels dense. Get all 3 layers right, and the bite is the perfect cross-section of 3 different moisture readings happening at once. Pajeon, moisture then crisp, not just crisp. Korean scallion pancakes are widely described in English language recipes as a crisp pancake. That description undersells the dish. A correctly made pajeon is moisture then crisp. The interior of the pancake holds the moisture of the egg and flour batter and the scallions and any seafood, while the surface that meets the pan goes through a controlled wet into dry transition that produces a brittle, lacy crust. The bite is a crisp edge and a creamy middle in the same mouthful. A pajeon that is crisp all the way through has been overcooked. The cook drove out the middle moisture along with the surface moisture, and the dish has become a cracker. The fix is higher heat, less time, and trusting the moisture transaction to stop at the right depth. Croque monsieur, bread as moisture-absorbing scaffold. The croque monsieur is the sponge family at its purest. 2 slices of bread enclose ham and gruyere. The assembled sandwich is brushed with bechamel and a second layer of cheese, then baked or broiled until the top is dark and crisp. During the bake, the bechamel and the inner cheese both melt and partially soak into the bread, which acts as the structural scaffold that holds the moisture in place while the surface develops its crust. A croque monsieur made with thin, soft supermarket sandwich bread soaks through and turns to mush. A croque monsieur made with stale, dense country bread holds the moisture exactly where it needs to be. The dish does not work without the right sponge. Common misunderstandings. Don't overcook it is not moisture advice. It is almost moisture advice, but it leaves out the mechanism, which makes it unusable when you are looking at the pan trying to decide what to do next. The mechanism is protein fibers squeeze water out past a certain temperature. The mechanism's corollary, if you can hold below that temperature for long enough, you can cook the protein safely without losing the water. Low temperature long cook methods, sous vide, slow oven, gentle braise, are not fancier cooking. They are cooking that has been redesigned around the moisture retention rule. Crisp is not the absence of moisture, A truly crisp food has some moisture inside, just none on its surface. A potato chip is dry through, but a perfectly fried chicken thigh has crisp skin and juicy meat. That is the entire reason the cook bothered to fry it. The cook's job in the crisp family is to drive moisture out of the surface fast enough that the interior never overheats. Salt does not draw out moisture everywhere. Salt drains some ingredients, cucumber, eggplant, cabbage, mushrooms in some cases, because the salt creates an osmotic gradient that pulls water out of the cell membranes. Salt does not drain everything. Meat held briefly in salt actually holds onto moisture better, not worse, because the dissolved salt rearranges the muscle proteins to hold more water. The folk wisdom salt draws out moisture is half right and dangerous because of the half it leaves out. Water is not the only moisture. Wine is moisture. Stock is moisture. Olive oil's water phase is moisture. The small amount of water dispersed in extra virgin oil contributes to the way it interacts with hot pans. Tomato is mostly moisture, even when it looks solid. Onion releases enormous amounts of moisture during the first 10 minutes of cooking. The cook who thinks in terms of water misses most of the Meister transactions in their own kitchen. The cook who thinks in terms of the liquid phase in whatever form it currently is gets a much more accurate picture. Crispy is not a technique, it is a result. This is the most common rookie language pattern. I want it to be crispy. Crispy is what you get when you have set up the right wet into dry transaction. The cook needs to describe the dish in terms of the transaction, not the outcome. I want the skin to be crisp, demands the question. Dry surface, hot pan, enough time? If those three are right, the skin is going to be crisp. If one is wrong, no amount of wanting will help. Chef's view. After 30 years of cooking, the texture lesson that has stayed with me most is also the smallest one. It is this. Garnish is not garnish. Garnish is the texture you forgot to put inside the dish. When a culinary student plates a dish that is creamy in the middle and creamy at the edges, and is asked, "What's missing?" The honest answer is almost always something with a different mouthfeel. A scattering of fried capers, a teaspoon of toasted nuts, a few crisp leaves of parsley fried in the oil that the dish was finished with, a pinch of fleur de sel, where the salt arrives in three distinct grains rather than dissolved into the sauce. These are not decoration. They are the second texture that lets the first texture be tasted. The professional kitchens that consistently produce dishes that feel alive do this without thinking about it. The garnish station is a texture station. The home cook who borrows that habit, one different mouthfeel added at the moment of plating, closes most of the gap between home cooking and restaurant cooking before any technique or any ingredient is upgraded. The corollary, less often stated, is also true. Dishes that are texturally honest about what they are tend to be more satisfying than dishes that try to fake a texture they don't have. A homemade hummus that is honestly grainy and tastes of fresh garlic is better than a homemade hummus that is desperately blended, trying to match a restaurant texture it will never have. The recognition that the texture is part of the dish's identity, not a defect, is the small humility that lets the dish be itself. Texture is also where seasonality shows up most directly. A summer tomato has a yielding moisture that no winter tomato can match. A spring asparagus has a fibrous crunch that a December asparagus has lost. The cook who is paying attention to texture is, by accident, paying attention to seasonality too, because the textural collapse of an out-of-season ingredient is the first signal that the ingredient is wrong for the moment. Moisture is a transaction, not a state. Every cooking step moves water from one place to another, or refuses to let it move. The four transactions, wet into fat, wet into dry, dry into wet, dry into dry, cover almost every cooking move you will ever make. The three jobs of moisture, hydration, distribution, retention, are independent. Most home kitchen failures are one of the three jobs going wrong, while the other two are doing fine. Texture contrast is not garnish, it is architecture. Nearly every dish you love has at least one crisp element and one yielding element on the same fork. The home cook who closes that gap closes most of the gap between home cooking and restaurant cooking. The five moisture families, set, drain, carry, sponge, crisp, give cuisines as different as Japanese and Mediterranean a shared grammar. The custard and the brandade are doing the same thing from opposite directions. The risotto and the croque monsieur are both moisture carriers across an ingredient that wants to drink. The cook who can read a dish as belonging to one of these five families can predict its failure modes before the dish is half cooked. The chapter ends where it began. Texture is the cook's most underused tool, and the cook who pays attention to it gains a second instrument for free.